Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy, squeezing your brain and messing with your mind and hopefully keeping you up so late you have to call in sick tomorrow morning. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. Hope you and your family had a wonderful Easter Sunday, and I'm glad you're topping off your holiday by tuning in tonight. My name is George Knapp. I'm your host, the third and fourth Sundays of each month, your trail guide, your designated driver of the airwaves, at least for the next few hours. And we're going to have some fun tonight. Coming up in this hour, we'll be joined by Luke Fortune, who put together a series of six books, massive books, examining UFO-type propulsion and craft. These aren't some flying saucers made on some alien planet, but rather nuts and bolts objects designed and patented by plain old human beings. And you won't believe how many of them have been patented by scientists over the years in our country and other countries, and maybe we can all learn how to build our own. Then in the next hour, we'll be linked up to London to interview internationally known best-selling author Philip Gardner. I know that he's been a guest on the program in previous years, but not to talk about what we're going to discuss tonight. It's something called the Bond Code, all about these dark secrets and weird stuff associated with the James Bond character and the real-life spook who created that character, author Ian Fleming, who it turns out was into some really strange and occult stuff and has apparently left behind some clues about what he was up to. And Philip has written about this and a lot of other topics, best-selling books that I know are of interest to our Coast listeners, secret societies, Holy Grail, that kind of stuff, and we'll cover as much of it as we can. One programming note before we get into some news of interest. I want to thank all those who sent emails in about last week's show. We interviewed, if you tuned in, you know, we interviewed a former mobster named Tony Nastasi, who helped the FBI infiltrate the mafia in New York and here in Las Vegas to thwart some plans by some hitmen, some very bad customers who had intentions of taking over the escort service industry. And most of you who wrote say you really enjoyed the show, even though, you know, it seems like it's sort of outside the boundary of what Coast to Coast is about. And some of you didn't want to listen, but you did anyway, and you were drawn in by Tony's stories, and you ended up enjoying it. And I know a few listeners were kind of angry at me and the show for including this subject, and can't understand why we'd even have Tony on. I understand that, too, because mafia stuff is not UFOs or paranormal or ghosts or cover-ups. I think it certainly qualifies a conspiracy, but I understand where you're coming from on that, because it is different from what the normal topics are. So just so you know, I was the one who pitched that idea to the producers, and they said yes. I guess even though some mob stuff is outside the normal topic range, that I was told that on occasion on the show, they do have shows dedicated to what they call a first-person type narrative, and I think Ian Punnett hosts a lot of these. If the guest and the subject matter are of broad interest to the public, you know, sometimes it's kind of fun to change the tune a little bit and expand the topic list, which is what we did last week. And most of you seem to like it, as I said. One thing I've learned, though, in my brief tenure in this chair on the show is that, you know, it doesn't matter what the topic is, there's someone out there who isn't going to like it. And, you know, that's to be expected. I've had listeners complain when I have a UFO guest on. You know, what? UFOs again? Are you kidding me? And although, you know, one would think that would be a subject that listeners in this program would be interested in, but not everybody wants to hear it all the time. So, look, you're the listeners. And as I've said before, this program is an interactive process. We need your participation. So your feedback is important, and it's certainly important to me. I just wanted you to know that I'm not trying to change the format of the show or the focus or anything, but just once in a while, maybe once or twice a year, we might venture out of the chalk lines. Assuming we come up with the right kind of guest, you know, we, of course, hope that you'll give it a chance when it happens. But understand that if you want to call it a night, get some shut eye, hopefully tune back in the next night to see what else is going on. And, you know, I don't think everyone expects all 2 million of you out there or more to be enthralled with every guest every night. So I'm not griping. I'm not whining. I like getting your emails. I like getting your feedback, even when you're teeing off on me. because it gives me insight into what works and what doesn't. So I just want to let you know, no changes in the works for the show. We tried it. It was fun for most of you. We might do it again sometime down the road if we get the right guest and the right topic. So that's that for now. And keep those emails coming. I try to answer as many as I can, but I read them all, and I enjoy the heck out of the give-and-take process. Here's some cheery news for my neighbors here in Las Vegas. The Congressional Quarterly has put out its annual ranking of the most dangerous states in the country, ranking them all 1 through 50. The criteria were murder, rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, and motor thefts, and they put all that stuff into computers and ranked it. And, of course, Nevada, is ranked as the most dangerous state in the country. I think Louisiana is number 2. And let's see, the safest state, Maine, New Hampshire, 5 most dangerous, Nevada, Louisiana, New Mexico, South Carolina, Arizona, Tennessee, Maryland. I think if you probably went on the website of the Congressional Quarterly, you can get the whole list if you're anxious to see how your state ranks. They call this thing the Most Dangerous State Award. And I'm not sure award is the word I'd use. Seems like a kind of a dubious award. Of course, the reason Nevada's at the top of these kinds of lists is our growth here. It's a transient population. It's tough for government services to ever catch up, roads, schools, things like that. And now we've got this big problem barreling our way, and you probably got problems like this in your neck of the woods, too. We've basically outgrown our water supply. Most of Las Vegas's water is taken from the Colorado River, and we've got a drought out here in the Southwest. It's been going on for 8-9 years now. No other states, of course, are willing to part with any of their water, so Las Vegas is embarking on this largest public works program in its history. It's going after groundwater in rural areas of our state. And this thing could cost $8 or $10 billion. It's got a pipeline system, a series of wells and pumping stations that could stretch out of Las Vegas 600 miles into rural areas. Who knows, you know, $6 or $8 or $10 billion by the time they build it. It's government building it, after all. It could be a lot more than that. And the people who live out there, I've been going out over the last couple of months, they're really scared. I mean, they feel like they're being sacrificed so Las Vegas can keep growing like a bat out of hell, adding 5,000 people a month. And I think they got a point, you know. And then there are environmental concerns, some predictions the 150 or more species will be wiped out when the groundwater is taken out. It's the kind of issue that's made more serious because of climate change. And I'm not going to get into the whole debate about whether humans are causing climate change, but I'd say the consensus of scientific opinion is that our climate is changing, and in drastic ways. You know, tens of millions of people depend on the water from the Colorado River, and there simply isn't going to be as much in future years. There's not as much snowfall in the Rockies, so not as much snow melt going into the river. And this is the kind of thing that wars are fought over. I've been out there in rural Nevada talking to these ranchers and farmers. They're scared, they're angry, and I think it could really get ugly before it's over. It sort of leads into something I want to talk about for the rest of this half hour, and that's this global climate change stuff a little bit. There's some other news out of England. We're going to get to that when we come back. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. We were talking before the break about global climate change and what's going on in the world. Here's a doom and gloom prediction from a British scientist. It was in the Daily Mail earlier this week, a newspaper in London. This guy's name is James Lovelock, a climate change scientist, pretty well known in Europe. He's predicting that by 2040, the world population of more than 6 billion people will have been culled by floods, drought, and famine. The people of Southern Europe as well as Southeast Asia will be fighting their way into countries like Canada and Australia and Britain. He says the subsequent ethnic tensions could lead to civil war. Basically, Dr. Lovelock thinks that we're all doomed. That's the headline. We're all doomed 40 years from now, global catastrophe, and there's nothing we can do about it, nothing we can do to change it. Too late to repair the damage, Dr. Lovelock says. He says we're beyond the tipping point. He says nature is adapting to the changing climate, and Lovelock argues that humankind will have to do the same. We'll face a ruthless period of natural selection. He says, quote, I reckon there are about 80% more people than the world can carry now, which means he figures 80% of the world's population will have to die. He said by 2040, he predicts that parts of the Sahara Desert will have moved into middle Europe. We're talking about Paris, as far north as Berlin. He thinks that Britain will not be entirely unaffected, but he suggests that they build a seawall around the whole island. By 2040, China, he says, will be uninhabitable. He thinks the Chinese, because of their high levels of industrial activity, will be the first to suffer with the death of all their plant life. And he's predicting the Chinese will move en masse to Africa. He says they're already there, sort of preparing the way. They got Chinese industrialists there mining minerals, but he thinks it's just a pretext for a much bigger move. Dr. Lovelock predicts Australians have enough land and resources to stay put. Americans will end up moving to Canada. All sounds pretty grim. He discounts the possibility of any technological solutions. I don't know. There is some talk of spraying the skies with different kinds of chemicals to deflect sunlight. And maybe that is what all those chemtrail planes are about up there. I don't know. As a corollary to this story, something else I saw in the news. This is from the Associated Press. The headline is Beijing aims to control weather at the Olympic Games. And the story is about how the Chinese are worried that it might rain and spoil the opening and closing ceremonies at the Olympic Games coming up this summer. So they've got a whole big program going to where they are going to try to control the weather if it gets out of hand. They're spending $40 billion to remake their infrastructure to get ready for the games. They're spending $100 million a year, and 50,000 people are involved in this program to make rain at installations like one called Fragrant Hills, which is outside of Beijing. These peasants don these military fatigues and helmets, and then they squat behind anti-aircraft guns and rocket launchers, blasting the sky with silver iodide, hoping to shock rain from the clouds. I guess if rain threatens the opening or closing ceremonies, they'll send all these folks out there and start bombarding the clouds and try to drive them away, which they've got 11,000 weapons as part of this thing. So I'm thinking to myself, you know, the Chinese are going to look pretty silly because no one's ever really succeeded in doing this sort of a thing. The whole world's media will be there for the Olympic Games. I think they're going to notice 11,000 artillery pieces firing shells into the air to try to chase clouds away. And it just seems to me they could look pretty ridiculous if they don't do it. Now, in China, around Beijing, I guess the average rainfall in the month of August is 7 inches of rain. So it's a legitimate concern. But, man, I wish we had 7 inches of rain in a month here. We could really use it. Also in science news, hope you saw this story. This version of it is from the BBC, but it's about Mars. Did you see this one, how it's covered in table salt? The article says, Mars appeared to be covered in salt crystals from ancient dried-up lakes, the new evidence suggests. A NASA probe has found signs that the southern hemisphere is dusted with chloride mineral, perhaps table salt. U.S. scientists think the mineral formed when water evaporated from salty lakes or soil billions of years ago. The deposits are similar to salt pans here on Earth. And, of course, they'd be a good place to search for traces of past life, which could be preserved in salt, according to this article in the journal Science. The evidence comes from a camera on the Mars Odyssey, which has been mapping the red planet, I think, since 2002? Quite a while. Anyway, they've found 200 places of interest on the planet, and the discovery suggests that there was once a heck of a lot of water near the surface of Mars and as some kind of a source of energy. One of the scientists involved in this program, he's from the University of Arizona, he says salt is an excellent means of preserving organic material. So if there was life present in the distant past, that signature might still be there, which, man, that would be exciting news. A similar vein, this news about one of the moons of Saturn, Titan, of course, which has been long speculated by scientists that it might harbor life and it might have liquid water. And now they have some new evidence out of Pasadena, California. Scientists say they found the best evidence yet that an ocean of liquid water may be hidden below the surface of Saturn's giant moon, Titan. They use these modeling techniques, and then scientists determine that winds in Titan's atmosphere exert a torque on the lunar surface, and they concluded there must be some kind of liquid ocean below because such a large shift would not be seen if the interior was a solid core. So if this internal ocean exists on Titan, it would likely be buried below 62 miles of ice, and it'd be made of water and traces of ammonia. So I'm not quite sure what kind of life would exist in that kind of an environment, but they're hopeful. And it's nice to see mainstream scientists actually taking an interest in this and willing to pursue the possibility that there is life somewhere other than Earth. Because as listeners of this program know very well, most mainstream scientists don't want to get into these kinds of exotic topics, at least not the possibility that any of these other life forms might have come here. One other story, this is also from the world of technology. The headline is that religion colors our views of nanotechnology, and it's from Science Daily. It says it asked the question whether nanotechnology is morally acceptable. And for a significant percentage of Americans, the answer is no, according to this recent survey of American attitudes about the science of the very small. I guess this survey shows that religion exerts far more influence on public views of technology in the U.S. than it does in Europe. Of course, you know about nanotechnology. They make very, very small things, the smallest achievable scale, materials, structures, circuits, things of that sort. They've already got a lot of products that contain nanoscale materials and devices and doing all kinds of stuff. But in this sample, in this survey, only 29% of respondents, Americans, agreed that nanotechnology is morally acceptable. And these guys, the scientists doing this, are figuring that America's strong religious convictions, that people have sort of lumped nanotechnology and biotechnology in with stem cell research into areas where they're sort of playing God, which I don't know. I don't know if that nanotechnology could save somebody's life. I mean, I think it would be worth checking out. And here is the perfect example of why nanotechnology is worth pursuing. The headline is, and this is from the BBC, "Self-cleaning bathroom on the way. Nanotechnology may yet rescue us from the drudgery of the weekly ritual of blitzing the bathroom. Scientists in Australia have developed an environmentally friendly coating containing special nanoparticles that could do the job of cleaning and disinfecting for us. So I guess if you have these self-cleaning materials, you could do the job without having to use disinfectants or other chemicals. And these surfaces that they spray stuff in these bathrooms with, I guess in the future, they contain these tiny particles of titanium dioxide, which it becomes kind of excited when it absorbs ultraviolet light. And this gives the particles an oxidizing ability stronger than chlorine bleach. So the excited particles break down organic compounds and kill bacteria. And I think that those survey results we heard about a couple of minutes ago would be a lot different if the folks who were asked about this stuff knew that this could clean their bathrooms for them. They might have a different attitude. This is a really sad story that I saw. Somebody sent me on the internet, and I don't know if you've seen it or not. It certainly was widely circulated. It's about this woman who was the subject of a fight over euthanasia in France. And I guess what grabbed me was the picture, this picture. Her name is Chantal Sabir, and she died this week at the age of 52. She has this incurable facial tumor. And because she had this and what it's done to her health and her appearance, she wanted to commit suicide and wanted permission to do it legally and couldn't get it. So this is the story as reported by the Associated Press. French woman with an incurable facial tumor who lost a legal challenge seeking euthanasia died at her home near Dijon. Former schoolteacher Chantal Sabir, a mother of three, had asked a French court to allow doctors to help her die. The cause of her death, I guess right now, is not known, but her tumor had left her blind, disfigured, and suffering intense pain. The court had said that, you know, they sympathized with it. They thought her physical condition inspired compassion, but that the law could not bend even for her. And what really grabbed me, as I mentioned, is this photo, this woman's face. If you can find it anywhere on the internet, you should take a look, because it's really very sobering and disturbing. And for this woman who's in terrible pain for most of her adult life to not be given the right to take her own life, which I don't know. Who owns her life? Whose life is it? Ending this segment on a somewhat happier note, this report was sent to me. It's an article from New Scientist, and the headline is "Why Men Should Pair Off with Younger Women." Last year, a study of Swedish census information suggested a 4 to 6 year age gap is best. But there's new research using that same data has found that in some circumstances, a surprisingly large age gap, 15 years, is the optimum. The scientists from the University of Vienna looked at this information and said that men, where you have a 15-year age difference, men to women, that you have more children. And who are we to argue with cold, hard scientific fact? We're going to take a break. When we come back, Luke Fortune is going to tell us how to make a UFO. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM. Well, it's not George Norrie, it's George Knapp, but you know what? We're interchangeable. This is Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. If you're like me, you saw the Jetsons, that show, growing up, and you probably wondered, when the heck are we going to get some flying cars anyway? Well, the guest coming up is going to tell us how you can build your own. That song, by the way, by the Police, it's perfect because it is perfect transition, because walking on the moon is something you could do for yourself if what Luke Fortune is selling is accurate. And we're going to take a short break, and as soon as we're coming back, we'll tell you how to build one. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm George Knapp. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp, and I'm joined now by Luke Fortune, who is a certified paralegal who's been aggressively investigating UFOs since 1997. He had some sort of an experience of his own, a sighting of something that looked like a plasma propulsion craft. So he began researching the archives of the U.S. Patent Office and then other patent offices and looking for UFO technology. And believe me, he found a heck of a lot of it. And he's put them into a series of books called UFO How To. Luke, welcome.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You know, I've only read two of the books. I got them earlier this week and devoured them, and very interesting stuff. But I noticed in both of them, you start in the beginning by telling the audience or your readers that you're not a debunker. My question is, why did you feel you had to tell them that?
Well, when I first came out with the message, I received a lot of hostile responses from people who seemed to think that I was a debunker. In their mind, it seemed to equate that if we did have the technology, if we did possess the technology, that for some reason that must mean that aliens are a fraud, and that is not my position. I have never taken the position, and it seemed to be a recurring concern that people had, so I just decided to implement it so that people knew right off the bat, I'm not about debunking, I'm not about proving that aliens don't exist. What I am about proving is that UFOs are just unidentified objects. UFOs, we now have the answers to, that we are capable of building and replicating the kinds of craft that people are seeing and recording. Glowing balls of light in the sky, high-speed maneuvers, that sort of thing.
Is a ton of material. I mean, just in the two volumes that I've got, that just a huge amount of material. How much do you have, and how did you collect it?
Well, as you stated earlier, I had my first viewing in 1997. I saw a craft that just defied what airplanes were capable of, and I wanted to know. And so I began pursuing and looking at every option and venue that I could think of, and began doing research at the patent office, because I was actually doing some patent work for someone, and stumbled upon these, what I will call, exotic propulsion systems. And I began assimilating all this information for my own purposes, but there was such a large volume. There was such a large volume keeping it in the database, I realized that people would want to know. And as I saw the financial situation of our country growing more and more dire, you know, when we had the Enron scandal, for example, or the dot-com bust, or now the subprime mortgage debacle, you know, we really need to renovate our economy and the global economy. And with this technology, we can do just that.
You said you started for your own purposes, meaning you wanted to build one yourself?
Absolutely.
And have you?
I have begun work and undertaking in that direction. It's a matter of trying to get the funding and financing.
You break it down into different types. Tell the listeners what the types are.
Well, there are a lot of people who are going to say, you know, we noticed that the first book is called 100 Years, and then you have the other categories, 100 Years of UFO Patents. And the reason I started that was, as I said, you know, just for my own purposes, and I saw that the technology went back that far. As I was looking at the photographs, the earliest ones that I could find, I recognized that these patents did describe crafts that people were photographing and were matching the abilities that they were perceiving. So we go with the first book initially of just 100 years and approaching various types of craft and different things, and then we get more specific, the electrogravitic craft. Some people have an aversion to that word electrogravitic because they don't really, perhaps, say, grasp it fully. I use it as a blanket term for all the electromagnetic propulsion systems. Then you go into the plasma propulsion, which is what, you know, initially drew me in here, basically a high-powered rocketry, magnetohydrodynamics, which is the science, the patents that explain how a craft can appear like a glowing ball of light and be invisible to radar. And then the final two were included because of friends with interest in inertial propulsion systems and in fusion and antimatter designs.
You know, what you don't get into in this is whether any of these are actually ever built. I mean, you have all the interesting information about what they look like and diagrams of how you could build your own and how big they could be and who filed the patents. And those are some interesting names as well. But have you followed up to ask any of these guys to contact the guys who have the patents to see if they actually built one?
Well, a lot of the people from the patents that are there aren't available for contact because, you know, they've moved on in this life.
Right.
The things that I have been able to find and have been able to research, the patent office does not always require, except when they hear extraordinary claims, when they hear claims that appear to be supernatural or unbelievable, they have the right to exercise and require people to provide working prototypes.
And I noticed that I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I noticed that one of those was filed by a scientist who worked for Lockheed way back when. Was that some years ago?
There are several scientists that fall within that category. Lockheed and other, say NASA, GE Aerospace. One of my favorite of the inventors and the one that I think deserves the most credit, a lot of people will say Thomas Townsend Brown. Yes, he does deserve it, and he does get a prominent place, but is Henry William Wallace. He is the gentleman who discovered the technology that makes it possible for people to survive inside a craft that is making, say, right-angle maneuvers at thousands of miles per hour.
Well, that's an interesting point because it's what a lot of people use to say UFOs couldn't have occupants because the occupants couldn't survive the G-forces. So what is the explanation for how that works, how you avoid that?
Well, on my website at UFOHowTo.com, I try to explain that in detail. I also do that in the book, The Basics, which is a shorter version. You'll note that the other books, which were originally six, I've now expanded to nine. Each one are over 500 pages in length, except The Basics, which is about 120. Long story short, there are certain materials that, when given a very, very high-speed rotation or otherwise stimulated and excited, say like with high-voltage impulses, they create this field, a distortion field. Wallace referred to it as a kinematic field, and this causes propulsion and movement in a direction. It also creates the gravity and inertia nullifying effect.
Back to this thing about the Lockheed thing. You're familiar with Area 51 and all the stories
yes,
that I've been reported over the years and others have reported. And, Lockheed has always had a presence out there. There have been reports and stories of very exotic craft being developed by the Skunk Works out and tested out there. We know some of them have made it out into the public world. There are rumors of other more exotic things that maybe have incorporated UFO technology in there. The fact that you have Lockheed scientists filing patent applications more than once, it sort of lends credence to some of those stories.
Absolutely.
And have you contacted Lockheed to ask them, hey, did you get this thing up and going?
I had tried to get a hold of Lockheed and tried to get a hold of Boeing. I was unable to get responses on my requests.
So you are you're sort of in the process of maybe building one of these things yourself. I mean, it would seem to me it's an awfully tough process. Although some of this information is very simple, even for non-technical people like me, the building of it. I mean, you got to have some kind of engineering skills, don't you?
Well, what I've discovered is that the ability probably exists within the grasp of more people than they realize. A person who can work with machining tools, say like having taken high school metal shop classes, a person who's ever worked with ceramics, like manufacturing a pottery, or a person who's ever done electrical repairs on a car, like replacing an alternator, they possess the ability, they possess the skill set, if they can follow directions, to build.
Well, that lets me out. Tell me this, some of the diagrams, they show things that sure as heck look like a flying saucer. And I wonder, is there something, some engineering reason, some aerodynamic reason why the saucer shape would work for these kinds of technologies?
Well, for the airfoil designs, you're looking at aerodynamics and control elements. With the electrogravitic technologies, you would be looking at. Every once in a while, you come across a photograph of a flying saucer, and the saucer appears to be tilted at an angle or almost even on its side. That vast area surface would be ideally for, say, an electrogravitic propulsion system. That would be a high-K dielectric, a material that's very good at absorbing electricity in a capacitive sense, likewise containing the odd nuclear spin values. You're actually exciting on an atomic level. You're exciting the nucleus of the materials. And the more area that you cover, the greater the propulsive effect, but also more areas inside of the craft are protected by that kinematic field, that inertia-canceling field.
So if you could build one of these things, you could go anywhere that we figure aliens, if they exist, are going, right? Well, zip to the moon, zip to Mars?
You could definitely go anywhere within the solar system. Thomas Townsend Brown, who did much of the pioneering work, in his time he referred to it as electrokinetic work rather than electrogravitic. He believed that it was possible to achieve speeds greater than the speed of light in a vacuum. And so there opens the possibility in the doorway that perhaps transport to other star systems could be possible. But certainly you could reach other points in the solar system, our solar system, which is part of the reason why I'm pushing so hard to try and get the word out now. Because moving into the solar system, we could avoid, you were speaking about a scientist who believed that 4 out of 5 people needed to die because the Earth is overpopulated. We don't need to sacrifice people. We just need to expand into the solar system, and here is a technology to do so. You know, we can start with a life of living in space stations or moon bases, or you know, setting people out to do prospecting on the asteroid belt or on Jupiter's moons. I mean, this can become a reality with this technology.
Well, yeah, you heard my wisecrack about the Jetsons, but yeah, I'd love to have a flying car.
We've been promised that since we were kids. Where is it? Well, it's here, but we're conditioned to live in this pay-per-use system. Okay, they want us, from the profit standpoint, there's always been the concern about trying to milk the most profit out of the people, so let's not talk about this technology and say, well, we're just offering what the market will bear. Well, people are concerned, and now they're having to face the reality of peak oil approaching. The president himself and every presidential candidate is talking about, you know, getting off of oil, gasoline, looking at alternative fuels. So I released the final 3 books, or I should say the latest 3 books, in the UFO How-To on Power Systems, the final of which is about hydrogen technology that is in the public domain, with a particular emphasis to be able to convert your automobile to run on water.
Well, I know a guy who's done that, and he's got all sorts of grief from it. That brings us to the obvious question, though. You know, your book is listing patents that have been filed for 100 years, so where are these things? If any of these people have built them and they do work, where are they? I mean, obviously, some of the things that we're seeing in the sky as UFOs could be some of these Earth-made, still UFOs, but not made by aliens, made by Earthmen. But obviously, they're not selling them in flying car lots down on Main Street.
Well, if you're talking about the power systems, or you're talking about the actual flying craft.
Well, I guess the combination of the two, because you need the propulsion and the craft to get up there.
In taking a look at, say, we'll address the power systems, the first part, and fuel, you can go back to as far as the 1920s, I found, and find patents being filed for high-performance carburetors, carburetors that get exceptionally good gas mileage. And many of these, they were bought by oil interests. They were bought, and they were shelved, and they were never manufactured. There are a lot of horror stories, which I will neither confirm nor deny at this point, about, you know, people and their lives being threatened and et cetera. Whether they were implemented, they were not implemented because of that or because they were shelved, you know, you have to follow the money trail. Who stands to benefit by something like this not coming to market?
Exactly. Or maybe there's a national security application that this stuff is all in the hands of the military because they don't want regular folks or bad guys having it.
Well, there are over 3,000 patents that are currently classified. They're not available for anyone to review under the interests of national security. So as you've seen by the books that I've provided for you to review, there is a huge volume available. You can only imagine what is out there that is not.
Well, that makes you wonder why they let these ones out.
Well, some of them, I think, slipped under the radar, like Henry Wallace's work. His method and apparatus for generating a secondary gravitational force field or for generating a dynamic force field I think both of those kind of slipped under the radar. Perhaps they didn't realize at the time what was going on. Military didn't know what to look for. You know, who knows?
Was it difficult to get the information? Did you have to use FOIA, or did the patent office give you what you needed? And the same question applies to foreign offices, too.
Well, I found most patent offices... I should rephrase that. I found the U.S. patent office to be very, very agreeable and easy to work with. There wasn't a necessity to get into, you know, any sort of legal strong-arming. Just a matter of knowing how to do the research and how to pull it out. But when you've got a system that has over 7 million different filings in it, it's easy to lose stuff. The U.S. patent office is not the only place that I've seen this technology emerging. There are a couple of patents which I've translated from the French. There's only about maybe two or three total, a few from Great Britain and a couple from Canada. But this technology is cropping up everywhere. As UFO sightings increase, so do the number of filings. I found filings for UFO propulsion systems, I'll call them exotic propulsion systems, EPS, in Russia, in Germany, in Italy, in Hungary, Spain, China, Korea, Japan. You know, people need to be taking this into consideration as more and more UFOs are being seen every year. Likewise, the number of filings are going up.
Yeah, well, it's a race. You know, in your books, you got these warnings, too, in big, bold letters about warning. It's basically telling people, don't do this at home unless you know what you're doing, because it's some dangerous stuff. I mean, it is dangerous, isn't it, some of this technology or this apparatus?
Well, in the electrogravitic systems, you're dealing with high-voltage electricity. And if you're using alternating current, like, say, Nikola Tesla had originally envisioned, you know, there it would be safer with higher frequencies. But a lot of the stuff involves direct current and high voltages of direct current, which can be fatal if you, you know, touch the wrong wires together. So it really is important that a person who wants to undergo on this has basic understandings of electricity and knows about the safety factors when dealing with high voltages.
You're working on one. You're building something yourself. So obviously you've looked at all these pages and figured out which one works or which one looks best to you, right? Or have you combined a couple of them?
You could say that I combined. The thing that I found is that, like with the why the books are subdivided in their different categories, why a plasma propulsion, why a magnetohydrodynamics, why electrogravitics, you can say yes, there are the different subcategories, but it's almost as if the same patent keeps getting reissued because people have different terminologies over the years. Each person, like say, for example, in the electrogravitics, they discover that high-voltage electrical impulses applied in the right way cause a propulsive effect, but they don't know how to describe it. So they put it in their best terminology. Well, 10, 15 years later, another person thinks they've discovered it. They put it in their terminology, and things have modified and evolved. So you end up with the same designs being repatented just because of the communication barrier.
Right. Now, six volumes, not everybody's going to buy all six, so I don't need to buy all six to know how to build a UFO, do I?
No, sir. You could, with any single volume that you purchased, you could design and build a flying craft that operates as UFOs seen, filmed, and video recorded. It was just, what is your preference? You know, like I have friends who are, like I said, who are really big on the idea of fusion systems, cold fusion systems, and the idea of working with antimatter. So I compiled the information that I found, which covers those categories and is applicable to the flying craft. But, you know, that's someone else's. I'm personally drawn to the electrogravitic and magnetohydrodynamic.
Well, thanks. That saves us a lot of time there, Luke. Luke Fortune, good luck with your books, UFO How-To, and there's a website, ufohowto.com. And after you get this thing built and you're flying around, call us back. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with our guest, Philip Gardner. I'm George Knapp on Coast to Coast AM.